And so if you want to make money, generally speaking, you will have to be useful to someone. You will have to be, you know, position yourself that you are helping them make money so they will pay you money. And here are the three main paths that you can do that. And while you're doing it, you will build up your own skills.
Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of Media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Iron Age Marketing. As always, I am Nikki P. Today, I'm here with Kristen McTiernan. This could be a little bit different of a show because normally we bring on people that are promoting fiction of some kind. But Kristen actually posted a book the other day that was a nonfiction book that I thought would really feed into, ways to better your marketing. It's maybe a roundabout way of looking at things, but it got the juices in my head flowing, and I kind of wanted to bring that to you here. But why don't we start out with you telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you find yourself here?
All right. Fantastic. Well, like you said, I am Kristen McTiernan, and I kind of had a very interesting way of ending up where I am. My business is the Nonsense Free Editor. And the reason I started it was to fund my fiction career. I joined the military right out of high school. And when I was done with that, I thought I wanted to be a high school English teacher. Writing and language arts are really the only thing I've ever been good at. There's no secondary skill set. It's just all books. But when I got into the student teaching portion, and this is even back in, you know, I think it was 2006 when I did my student teaching, I determined it was not the career path for me. And so I said, well, I've got this English degree. Well, what else do I do with it? What does one do with an English literature degree? And, I'm a military brat and I spent my time in the military. And so I looked at USA Jobs and found that actually the federal government needs a lot of editors. And, so I got an entry-level job as a technical editor, and that's really great because, you know, not to get too into it, but the stereotypes about federal employees are true. So I had a lot of time to work on my books while I was a federal employee, and I was strengthening my skills. And so I was being a technical editor, doing for flight manuals and curriculum material. So just kind of getting a trial by fire, becoming a better writer, becoming a better editor. And then when I moved back to my home state of Kansas, I was like, well, I kind of want to not just be a federal employee. I kind of want to start something for myself. And also self-publishing is expensive. And my first book, I did everything wrong. Oh, I'm so glad you have this for marketing because I just wrote it and put it up on Amazon because surely people will just find it. That's how it works, right? and I made the cover myself and it was awful. So on the second book, when I realized how much money it would take to do it properly with marketing and with a good cover and with an actual editor instead of just my mom, I was like, I need a side hustle. So I started doing that in 2011, and slowly but surely, the Nonsense Free Editor came into being, and I went out fully on my own, not under a contracting company, in 2017. And I've been doing it ever since.
Nice. Now, you do just editing, or are there other things that you've picked up in that time period? Usually ghostwriting goes along with it, things like that.
Yes. So I do developmental online editing. I do ghostwriting. I do self-publishing services. And this is usually for authors who either don't have the time or, you know, sometimes older people. They don't want to fiddle around with KDP. They don't want to do any of that. I'll just upload it for them. I'll do the formatting for, you know, kind of like the nuts and bolts of taking your finished book and getting it out. I do that.
I imagine you get a lot of that goes with, like, say, business people that I don't really care about a book, but someone told me their book will help me book podcasts. So here's a book. Let's get me booked.
Yeah. Nonfiction authors are really big on that. They don't want to be bothered with it. They're not authors. They're like, write it for me, format it for me, edit it for me, throw it up online for me, and send me a link. That, and then they send the link to their marketing person. That's all they want.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of the things I think that struck me when I saw your post on Twitter was that because so many people think of like the art as a creative process, I think that they forget for so many other people, it is just a thing that they have to get through to get to something at the other end. Like, especially within like the business community, they're not looking for creative. They're looking for the thing that distills my ideas into the simplest way I can get these out to people. And so, whereas, you know, they're thinking of, oh, this isn't an artistic endeavor. There's a lot of people. No, this is just a business transaction that I need to get through.
Hmm. And that's why I'm actually very picky about who I do fiction ghostwriting for, because what I've found is sometimes someone will come to me and they'll say, okay, you know, I'm ready to make this investment. I'm going to have you write my work of fiction for me. I've had this story in my head for a long time and I need to see it come to fruition, and I know I'll never write it myself. Fine, great, that sounds fantastic. But what they end up wanting is an assurance that it's going to be a bestseller because it deserves to be. And it's like, deserves got nothing to do with it, you know. And then from the movie quote, you know, marketing is what gets it done. You know, we've all seen these horrible books that just complete trash from top to bottom, which sell like gangbusters. It doesn't matter because it's got a pretty cover or because a celebrity endorsed it.
Takes a lot of money to do
a
that.
A lot though. Of money, and it's everywhere. And so people buy it just because they see it 10 million times in a row, and they just, fine, I'll buy it. I give in. I'll buy Fourth Wing.
My background's music, and that's how you manufacture pop songs, is that once you've heard a song more than like three times, it builds familiarity with the song, and then you just like it because you've heard it enough times. And that's how top 40 radio works. They just play it until you do like it.
Uh-huh. There is no world in which I should have liked the song Party in the USA, and yet I kept listening
to it. There's no world in which anyone should like that song. Clearly, we do not live in that. We live in the worst timeline.
We really do. It was so terrible.
But there's a lot of psychology and understanding like why that is the case. Like just comfort and familiarity and social proof. Those are the things that psychologically we can't do anything about. That's how we operate as animals. So what introduced you to this idea to wanting to write this book as opposed to like your normal fiction that you write?
Well, it was twofold. The thing that sparked the idea in my head was there was a bit of a Twitter furor about using AI specifically in book covers and art. And there was, I think he runs his own indie pub house, and he had said something nasty, like he was going to blackball any author that he found out had ever used AI in his work in a cover, not in the actual interior. And that irritated me. And I made a video about it. And the response to that, I saw these despairing authors who were like, well, why should I even continue? I can't afford those $2,000 covers that publishing house guy said that I need for my fantasy book. Should I even bother? Am I going to be blackballed if I work with a person who's not from America? Am I depriving an American artist of jobs? And there was just, and it wasn't being snarky. It was genuine despair of, I work a service job. I have a family. I can't afford to do what you're telling me to do to be respectable. So what do I do? And so that got me thinking. And of course I did my social media response, but I was like, well, I've never had to worry about that because I knew immediately I'm not cool enough to go viral on social media. I'm never going to be an influencer. If I want extra money, I need to get an extra job. And I can either do that, you know, with the gig economy and do service work and I'm not a people person. or I can use the skill I have.
A writer who's not a people person. Go figure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not one of those rare extroverted writers. Mm-mm, no. So, and I was like, well, this is the one thing I'm good at. So I'm going to start a side hustle. And initially it was. A lot of people don't want to start a business. You know, they don't want to leave their day job because they need health insurance or they need whatever. And the thing of my book is you don't have to. If you only want to make an extra $20,000 a year, that's perfectly respectable. And it's doable for just about anybody. You don't have to, you know, oh, live the dream and come and have a Maserati or whatever. No, just earn an extra $10,000 to $20,000 a year, fund your editor, fund your artist, You know, pick which part of making money writing resonates best with you and do that. And you can, and you don't have to be a marketing genius or a cool person on social media to do it.
Well, and it's, let's get people focused on so much of the art. Like my first writing gig that I had, like doing online work, I still have this gig to this day, which mostly consists of me using AI tools. Writing blog posts that need to be SEO, you know, set for an industry that I don't know anything about. But they want to put up blog posts to grab attention. Now, granted, this is becoming less and less thing because SEO matters less and less as everything is done through AI and ranking above the other things that are using AI to do their SEO becomes less and less of a thing. But the point being is that I could have, they could have had to go find someone who's an expert in that field to write those. They're never going to be able to afford anyone who's an expert in a field to waste their time writing blog posts because they're doing what they're doing. So, you know, having someone who knows enough to get the correct answers out of the AI to get it to write the thing and then make it look pretty, because we know anyone who's ever used AI, for me, the idea that AI is going to take over your job as a writer any day soon, or certainly copywriting is my background, they're going to take that is laughable to me. But, you know, there are quirks you have to work through. So, but that's a job that you don't, I came from music, so I've always been a man like, well, I've learned a skill set. I've learned how to perform. I learned how to play guitar and sing. And, you know, there's not a lot of money going out and doing that with original music. But I can go make $300 myself doing an acoustic gig on a Friday or Saturday night. And I have the skill set to do that. So why am I leaving money on the table that could be helping to facilitate what I actually want to do? You know, it's like, it's still way more fun to play guitar, even if it's just cover songs, than go sit in a factory for, you know, a day. Like, this is a no-brainer trade to me. Like, you have the skill set, utilize it to do what you want to do.
Definitely. And I never like to minimize the art or tell people, like, you know, your idea isn't as original as you think it is. I mean, nobody's idea is, but sometimes people get very hung up on, you know, the purity of the art and we have to do right by this story. And that's awesome. But would you be okay if your work didn't make any money, if you spent, you know, $2,000 on this editor and you didn't, and, you know, say you're artistic and you can do your own cover, would you be okay with never making a cent from it? And most people, even if it's not their full-time income, would say no, because you write a book because you want people to read it and you want people to talk about your book with you. But if they never see it, if they're never exposed to it, even if it's just a small community, then, you know, was it worth it?
Yeah. Well, in any of the arts, there you have to define why anyone does it. Like, there are those people who, like, I can't not write. I'm going to do this. And whether or not anybody ever reads it, like, it's not going to stop me from doing it because I need to be creative. I know musicians like that. But there are other people that's like, well, you know, I'm a dad. I've got a 10-year-old daughter. And if I'm going to spend a ton of time away from her on anything, it's kind of got to pull its own weight. Like, I can't just be doing art because it's fun at this point in my life. I need to, it better be pulling some money in or pulling some money in. Those are my options.
Right. Life gets in the way. And that's a big thing. And I do try to let people know that, you know, especially as a service provider. And I think now with the independent author economy, you know, there's a lot of poo-pooing, oh, you're just a shovel seller. You don't actually make money writing, you know, you make money with services. And that is true to the extent, but that's why I didn't write a book on, oh, here's how to make money by selling novels, because I haven't made enough money to write a book like that. But it's just like, well, what do you want to do? Okay, you want to do your art and you want to make money. Do you necessarily have to do both of those things with the same endeavor? You know, so that was my thought. It's just like, well, let's write something useful. And then you don't have to, like I said, you don't have to have a whole business. You don't have to leave your day job. You can just have a little something extra to set up. And especially for parents, you know, if you don't have a work from home job, just having that extra time where it's like, yeah, you don't have to get up and go drive, you know, an Uber or whatever. You can stay home with your kids and still earn extra money and do the thing that you love and also improve your skills while you're doing it.
Do you feel like the pushback is getting better or worse? Like the deeper we kind of move into this new renaissance or iron age, whatever you want to call it, of self-publishing?
I think it's a two-tiered system. So part of the giveaway of someone who is a tinkerer or a hobbyist, they've never even bothered looking into the business aspect. They tend to still be very snooty about it. They still think it's 2007. A lot of times people with trad pub aspirations will be like this, where it's like, oh, if I ever found out you used AI, even for outlining, I'm not going to speak to you again. It's usually people who have not waded in to the business side of authorship or art. They don't know what they're talking about. Once you get to the point where you put your heart and soul into something and you do everything right, you know, you have that big launch for your book, you have the marketing, you got the right cover, you got the editor, and it's still kind of crickets. That's once you get to that stage, people are usually much more receptive. It's like, okay, I spent the money I was supposed to, but did I spend it smartly? Did I spend it on the right people? Do I have enough coming in? You know, they kind of start shifting, and it's like, yeah, it doesn't make you less of an artist because you look at the business side as well as the art.
Well, and I know, like, I approach things from like the anarcho-capitalist marketer perspective, where it's like everything I do is looking at this from what's good for the customer. And I have difficulty really, I guess, caring about intellectual property in some ways, because at the end of the day, if there's better and more books for the people that purchase them, is the world a better place or not? And that's a better world, objectively. Now, am I personally enriched by that? Not necessarily. So I can understand where, like, there's a, well, I invested time in this and now I need to get my payment back on that. But that's, people have to deal. That's a very self-serving sort of way to look at it. And that's coming from the hardcore capitalist. Like, I understand that, like, we want what's good for the people, but we also need to be able to function. But people, they seem to want to, I don't know, they want to live in a world, an old world, where, in a world that they don't frankly understand, because most of the art that we think of, like, as being from back in the day, it existed in a patronage model. Like, you weren't just creating because you wanted to. You got to create because some super rich guy thought it was cool to have you making things for him, and you do some stuff on the side that, like, might stand the test of time. And it's, in a lot of ways, it's just misunderstanding what the system ever actually was versus, like, the, what's the word, like, for the romanticized version of it.
Oh, definitely. And even back to Shakespeare, I mean, when you study literature and you look at the things that he put in there, it's like, it's very clearly he was appeasing the royal family who was paying his bills. He was appeasing the new Protestant, you know, religious structure that was going on in England at the time versus the previous Catholic one. He wanted to keep his head, so he changed his writing. And of course, he was ripping off Petrarch at the time. So it's like, look, it's never been pure. It's never been a bolt of idea from the sky. And then, you know, it's yours and only yours. And then you are rightly rewarded for your creativity. You know, I wish it were more fair. And then there's the issue of, you know, having validation. It's like, a lot of times they're like, oh, I don't care if I make any money, but they do care very much for that validation, which is valid, by the way. If you do it only because you want to be well known within a certain circle, or if you want people just to think that you're a good writer, that's valid too. But you kind of still need marketing for that, because people need to know who you are. They need to find your book. They need to read your book. They need to like your book. And then they need to tell other people about your book. So it's like, you have to have that apparatus in place. And a lot of times, even if you have the money, do you have the time? So that's where the professionals come in.
Obviously, being a marketer, I talk to people all the time. It's like, well, I don't want to stop writing to do this stuff. But it's like, okay, well, then if you don't stop writing long enough to put together a decent promotional campaign, and you're not going to pay anyone to do that, then no one is going to come in who's a new reader, because they're never going to find you. It's going to sit is a PDF somewhere in a system that it just, no one's going to stumble onto this stuff unless you put it in front of them.
What is it, like a million books a day on Amazon? It's like a lot.
It's stupid. Like, it's absolutely silly, the amount of books. So you know, our generation thing that we've had to deal with is, you know, back when, that's why there was no superstar bands anymore or superstar musicians, because, you know, there's more than 12 people that get played on the radio now. Like the sort of 60s, 70s, like that was it. They had their names, they pushed them, and that's all you'd ever hear. Well, now there's all the noise. We have more things than we could ever dream of getting to, which is great for the consumer in that we can find the perfect thing for us. But that's also predicated on someone getting the perfect thing for us in front of us. And if you just let it sit on your website, you're certainly not doing that. So obviously there's a need for this. What is the kind of picture that you paint in your book? What does that look like in reality for the standard person?
For the standard person in the book that I just came out, it's like, look, you know, we're going to be very simple. I talk about copywriting, editing, and ghostwriting, how to get those started up, the nuts and bolts, nightmare clients, how to make sure you avoid them. Kind of like the, here is a much smoother path to starting to make money as a writing services provider. And the way that I frame it is, I do mention crowdfunding. I mention it right off the bat. It's kind of like, look, this is an option. And a lot of people have done this option. They've been very successful in crowdfunding. And I think that's more appealing to artists, particularly. I know that you're, you know, in the comic book space, you know, where there's a physical product, like a beautiful physical product with art. And that lends itself nicely to crowdfunding. But again, we're back to the issue of social media and marketing viability. And for me, I have never been successful in those. I absolutely have to hire people because I'm just not, I don't have that sauce. And so if you want to make money, generally speaking, you will have to be useful to someone. You will have to be, you know, position yourself that you are helping them make money so they will pay you money. And here are the three main paths that you can do that. And while you're doing it, you will build up your own skills. So like copywriting is the first one, because that's very often the lowest barrier to entry. You can just start up a copywriting, you know, with the skills that you have. So if you were a hairdresser in your previous life and you don't want to be a hairdresser anymore, you can be, you know, a beauty copywriter. You know, that's how you can start off. And it's a totally separate skill is what I do emphasize. It's not the same as writing a novel. It's not the same as writing a short story or a screenplay, which is why a lot of novelists like freeze at their blurb, because that's copywriting. It's a separate skill. It's totally different.
Well, for me, coming like copywriting is, the minute I got introduced to it, I fell in love. And the thing I fell in love with is the copywriting. The thing that makes me excel at it, where a lot of authors have difficulty, is I can talk. I can write stream of consciousness. I can write conversationally. Being able to write conversationally is the key to copywriting, because it needs to feel like a conversation to the person. Like that's the big part of it. And I can't tell you like how many people like you've seen authors have just like going in, not knowing what they're doing. It's like, oh, you wrote a paragraph that's nice.
Yeah.
Not really doing what it needs to do, but it's just learning a different skill set. It's learning kind of tweak what you already know. Like most of copywriting, I think, is learning the psychology of how people's brains work more than anything. And then just kind of saying what you need to say to trigger the right things to make things happen. So maybe I look at people like rats a little bit more than most people, but
I think that's very true. And I think that's why I struggle with it. It's like, I don't know, because I'm not a persuasive person. It's like, do you want to buy this? No. Okay. Like I don't do the sell me the pen thing. And so I think copywriters really understand. It's like, okay, well, what really inspires people where they're not even thinking about something? Well, I'm going to make you think of it. And in a way that, you know, you enjoy. And so that's a very different skill. And it's a very useful skill, and you can use it any number of ways.
I was working on the chapter on the Johari window for my marketing book for nerds that I'm writing actually just today. And it's like trying to explain the concept to somebody. It's like, it's not a complicated concept, but to utilize it appropriately, you know, and you know what the Johari window is? It's the idea that you have a window, four panes of glass. And for every person, there's what you know and what they know. There's what you know about them that they don't know. There's what they don't know and you don't know. And then there's the stuff that only they know and no one else knows. And the more of those four things that you can understand, you can build your avatar and you can pitch better people. And now in the age of big data, like being able to, there's parts of that where like that they don't know and we don't know, but the computers can figure out to make it even easier to sell. Like that's the real trick to what Amazon and Facebook learned, was that, well, we can learn shit that people don't even know themselves. So.
And that's what I found about advertising bros, like the ones who sell like an F ton of their books and you're like, how? This is so mid. And it's because they got a touch of the tism and they're really good with that data element and they can just drill down and find that exact right audience for this particular book. And I'm always in awe of the people, usually dudes, who just like really excel at that, like that granular book marketing. And you know, it's like, can I hire you?
Yes, you can. I'm over here, folks. You need help. Now, is there a particular copywriting you say would be the gateway, you think, for a lot of people? Do you have a particular way you envision people finding gigs in that particular, like those first gigs, how do you see them coming? I've had a lot of people pitch me like the Fiverr and things like that.
It depends on your personality.
I've never had any luck with any of those. Those have always been terrible. Now, give me a friend on Facebook that starts me off, and then a friend becomes two friends, and then they tell people. Almost all of the work I've gathered in my private career has been through somebody that I knew and did work for talking to somebody else. I could never make those websites work. Like the whole pitch anything, it's like, I don't want to do this. Like send out 300 of these for a gig I don't want. Like literally, as a copywriter, like I set up a part of my website specifically to tell people if you don't like these things about me, don't bother asking me for work because I don't want to work with you. Like that's been almost a bigger thing for me. It's like if I wanted to have an asshole boss, I could continue doing the shit I've done prior to this, you know? Like one of the beauties of doing this is we can pick the jobs we want and just get rid of everybody else.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. And how you get those clients, because in each of the chapters, the copywriting, editing, and ghostwriting, I do devote a section to client acquisition. Now, I am also on Fiverr. In addition to having my own business, it accounts for about 30% of my client acquisition. And then I get the rest, weirdly, from YouTube. YouTube has been huge for me. I make educational.
Second biggest search engine in the world.
Yeah. I make educational videos and I have 6,000 followers, but most of them don't watch. I get about 100 views in the first 24 hours for each of my videos. And then after about 6 months, one will just blow up. So the memoir one has blown up. The developmental editing one has blown up. So it's like 6 or 7 videos in a matter of 3 years, just those. And those continue to get me business over and over and over again. That has been huge. YouTube is the reason I was able to go out on my own because I worked for an agency called First Editing. That was how I got my start in freelance editing. And then I also got into Fiverr Pro specifically. Because when you first start on Fiverr, a lot of times you don't get pitched. People don't see your gigs. I got seen in a way that most people don't because I had that website. I had that presence. I was selected for Fiverr Pro. So the algorithm was much friendlier to me on Fiverr. I've never worked on Upwork because I didn't get any gigs on there that were real. I got a bunch of scammers being like, would you like to work for me for free? I promise you'll get paid later. No, no way. Mm-mm.
Yeah. And that was kind of like, I had friends that maybe 10 years ago made a lot of money doing that stuff and they built careers on that. And because they had those careers, maybe in like the heyday of when it was early, they had the website like them and it would, you know, funnel them stuff. But when I was getting in, I'm like, I'm getting nothing that like, you're going to pay me $5 an hour to do what? Like, no, if that was what I wanted to make, I'm going to go back to my job working at the factory. Like, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I like to recommend being everywhere. So Twitter has been huge for me as well. I wasn't really active on Twitter a lot. I think my account was basically dead for like the first year I was on there. Then Elon took over and it was kind of like a party. And so I started, interacting more and it was copywriters. I don't know how I fell into this copywriter algorithmic circle because I've never worked as a copywriter.
Because we're whores.
Yes. So we like big whores. You know, and then y'all tweet funny, engaging stuff. So the two big ones that I fell in with were Nabil Aziz and Chris Orzechowski. And they, for some reason, decided that I was friend-worthy. And then kind of I branched out from there and I started meeting people and business owners and I started getting work from there. It was just amazing. So YouTube and Twitter are like the big, you know, client capture areas for me. I'm technically on Facebook, but does anyone find work on Facebook?
I have connections to people on Facebook that I do, like, I find work because they're people like I've known forever and like they know me, but like it's more, it's just like that's how I talk to that particular sect of people. It's not anything to do with Facebook. Facebook used to be way better for everything, and it's become completely useless. Like I didn't even know that I would run ads on Facebook for anything, because it's just, you have to pay so much here for your ROI. It just doesn't make sense. My dude that got me into all this, Nathan Fraser, is telling me I'm an idiot right now as we speak, but that's because he's just a genius when it comes to understanding how pay-per-click and all that stuff works. But for like the network effect, it's just terrible. Like, unless you are an expert at knowing how to pay per click, then you're not getting much out of it.
Right. And, you know, I've got a lot of advertising.
Much friendlier in that respect. Cause, yeah. And I think it's because it is more of a social network. Mm-hmm. It just is.
Yeah. It's just to talk to each other. Whereas Facebook, like, you know, I get random people saying nasty things on Facebook in a way, you know, Twitter's got a reputation, but Facebook is where I get weird boomers who don't write and don't read for some reason commenting under my post. It's like, go away. Who are you? Ew. So it's
well, that would have been my one caveat. If my audience that was wanting to work for was over 60, I'd probably go for Facebook. That's still their place. And just having a thought, like, you know what? There's probably another reason you find a lot of copywriters is if you're on Twitter a lot, I mean, it kind of just lends to the copywriter mindset. Like, you've only got 280 characters to say something, so it's got to be informational and quippy. Go.
Right. And I struggle with that because I am a long-winded bastard. I just, when they came out with long tweets, I'm like, yes, finally, I don't have to truncate myself. But it was better when I did, because then it's like, you know, okay, what is a hook? Do that, you know, so people keep reading instead of just scrolling past your wall of text. And that's good for, you know, that's a good skill to have regardless of what you're doing. And I did mention in the book, it's like, look, you know, even if you don't want to be a copywriter, you do need this skill. Because you need to convince people to buy your book. You need to convince people to come to your website, you know, things like that. So, or write a blurb, you know, offering your services.
Like a thing that I always struggle with is, a person I work with, I had a conversation last night about it. He put up a new website and at the very top of his page is the name of the book. And like, that's what he's leading with. And so I call him, I'm like, hey, can you call me? And we talk and I'm like, I have to ask the question, what is the traffic that you're directing to this website? And I'm like, okay, so we get that. What is the likelihood that those people give a shit about the name of your book? And is that going to keep them reading to the next thing? Or do we have to hook them with what is the central idea or theme, or what is the thing that makes your book unique and interesting to someone? Like, can we make the pitch first? We'll get them to the name eventually. They're going to have the name. I don't even care if they get the name until after they buy the damn thing, but we want them to want to buy it. We need to start with that.
And I learned that the hard way, because like with my alternate fiction series, you know, I was doing the same thing. Oh, here's my title, or here's the title of the series. And instead, and this was during the 2016 election cycle, I, you know, put up a North America settled by the Spanish and ruled by the Vatican. That was like, oh, you know, because you had all the people who were worried we were going to turn into a theocracy, depending on how it went. So then they wanted to buy my book, even if they didn't necessarily, you know, read time travel fiction or fiction at all. They wanted to read that because it played into what they were already thinking about.
I bring it up every couple episodes that we, you know, I had a conversation with a guy who's got a book of, and he's trying to sell it. Oh, it's a Cthulhu kind of theme and, you know, Cthulhu detective thing. What, I don't know, something along that lines. And I'm like, okay, there's a lot of that. I can go get Cthulhu themed anything. So what makes you different? And then I'm talking to him about the book and we get into it and human trafficking comes up as part of it. I'm like, why are we not leading with that? The biggest movie in the country last year was a movie about child trafficking. Like, it's the thing that everyone's talking about. Everyone's thinking about every day. It is the conversation that we're having. And you're going to leave that bomb completely unused. That hook's just gone. And I never ended up seeing that in, you know, a particular person's, you know, marketing. And they struggled with their Kickstarter.
Well, yeah. And that's silly, especially when you think about, I think it was 2 years ago, the huge book that lit up Book Talk was, you know, Haunting Adeline. It's a filthy, smutty book, you know, not for everybody, but part of the whole thing that the male main character was doing is he was hunting human traffickers, and it was kind of like a QAnon-esque organization. And so that made, I mean, that's probably what pushed her from being just another smutty, you know, alpha daddy book into, hey, I'm getting picked up by a traditional publisher and it's getting, you know, it's lighting up Book Talk. So just having that something here and now in an otherwise fictional story, that's your hook. That's something that, you know, makes people interested. It's like, even if they wouldn't normally be interested in your book.
Well, the one thing I will ask as a criticism is that there are people, I have a friend that for the longest time, he was a graphic designer, great artist, but because graphic design was his business, it eventually became like, I couldn't get him to do anything for me because anything I'd want him to do, it felt like work. I'm like, come on, bro. I can get this great idea. It's like back in the old days in college. And it just is like, no, I don't want to work right now. It's just, it's work. Now, do you feel like there's a danger for like creative persons out there that this is going to turn the thing that they love and are maybe passionate about into work, into like a job that they ruins it outside of that?
Absolutely. Yes. And that's something to be very careful about. So last year I was burning out hardcore. I couldn't write my stuff. I was struggling to finish my client stuff. I was like, I don't even want to read. I don't care. So I actually had to step away for about a month. And when I came back, you know, luckily being in business for this long, I know a lot of really good writers, and I put out a call. I was like, look, I can't keep up with this. You know, I'm a victim of my success. I have too much. I can't quit. I need to hire some people. So I got in a place where I now have three writers working for me. Thank God. So now I write my stuff and I write the clients that I'm interested in. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a really awesome book. I can't wait to write that for you. And then the other ones, lucky them, you know, I give it to my other three writers. It's like, hey, I've got, you know, this nonfiction or I've got this fiction. Which one do you want? And they'll be like, all right, I want that one. And so we're all working a little more within our wheelhouse. It's more spread out. And no one is like, if I have to write another memoir, I'm going to fling myself into the sea. You know, you're not in that spot. And that is one thing I do caution about in the book. It's like, don't overwhelm yourself. So if you can only work on one client at a time, do that. You know, the money is so tempting. It's like, yeah, man, I could make, you know, $5,000 this month. That could really come in handy. What will you have to sacrifice to make that $5,000? And that is a really important question. Like, I'm not a parent. I just have a surly dog. But still, you know, I'm not a high energy person. So am I going to work a 12-hour day? I can do one. I can't even work two 12-hour days in a row. I will burn out. I will flame out. I will cry. So you need to be very protective of your time. It's like, or, you know, just say, hey, I can take this job on, but it's going to take me 60 days to do. Does your deadline accommodate that? And a lot of times, you know, for works like this, they'll say, yeah, it does. So like I'm right now, I've got an editing job. And I can't wait to edit it. I'm excited. But I told the person, I was like, it's going to be about 90 days before you get this back. Is that okay? And in this case, it was. And if not, I totally understand. You know, somebody would be better for you. But, you know, that you really need to be protective because you burnout is a thing. Yes.
So I guess the final question I'll ask you here is, what is the ideal client avatar? What is the person that you're going after with this? Ultimately, what is the person that's going to find the best use out of this, to not sound slimy?
The person that's going to find the best use out of this is, I'm going to say, either a beginner or an intermediate person who enjoys or is interested in copywriting. Because I do let you know how to get started. And even if it's just your resume from your day job, that counts. You know, someone who has at least one differentiating factor where you can show a client, yes, you should hire me. Yes, here is why I will do good with what you are paying me to do. And that's really all you need, because you're not building a business. You don't need an MBA. If you want to be a ghostwriter, I do specify that's got the highest barrier to entry. And if that's the only reason you're buying the book, I do say you need to have at least one book length work done. So, you know, if you've only done short stories, if you've only done blogs, you can't be a ghostwriter for a novel until you have at least that one work under your belt.
Someone's going to want to see that you're capable of doing the job. If you can't write your own book, I can't expect you to write my book.
Right. You need to have a portfolio. And for editing, you can always do a free sample of their work. It's like, yeah, let me edit 1,000, you know, words for you. That's easy peasy. So even if you have never edited anyone's work before, ever, you can still do that free sample and you can show them what you're worth. But ghostwriting is a different thing. That's a much higher barrier to entry. And that's why I did all three of them. So you can start from zero if you're a copywriter. You can start from zero if you're an editor. You can't start from zero with a ghostwriter. But if you want to work your way up, and I didn't start off ghostwriting. I started off editing based on the skills I learned in my day job. And then I slowly but surely worked up. And I think that everybody should do that if you want to. You know, I do it full time now, but not everybody wants to do that. So if you just want to offer services, and especially in the indie community, for me, I am big about the indie community. I don't really work with TradPub people a whole lot, not because I disdain them, but because they have a different mindset. And what they want is very different. So, you know, I do like to work with indies and know who you want to work with. If you're a person who used to work in Big Five and you're like, oh, I hate that. Fine, fair enough. But you still have that Big Five skill set. And that in some cases means you can charge more. So if you're editing for someone who wants to submit to the, you know, to the agent you used to work for, get that money, you know, and I put that in the book. It's like, here are certain angles that you can find. Here's how I price myself. Here's how maybe you want to price yourself, depending on what you have.
And one thing I will say is that when it comes to price, whatever magic there is to that, you're gonna learn on your own, because there is no set standard. You know, value doesn't get created that way. You know,
and for me, I said, you know, I think the independent editor, whatever they are, they said 3 cents a word for a developmental edit. I only charge 2 because I work with indies, and indies are out. They're nurses. They're working a rig. They're doing something. Okay. They are not people who are just sitting on stacks of cash from, you know, their dad or whatever. So I keep prices lower than market value.
Well, and maybe it's understanding the services that you can offer based on your client. Like for me, one of the things I learned when I came into this, the Iron Age space, was that what I would offer, most of the people that I talk to can't afford, period. And so that's why I started working on writing my book, because I can probably convince someone that $15 that's going to help them immensely be able to sell their product is probably more worthwhile than the thousands of dollars it would cost to secure me as like a, you know, partial CFO for their book, that kind of thing, or a CMO, whatever. That makes more sense to an independent artist as opposed to, you know, a guy who's going to work at the factory, comes home, spends a couple hours a night writing, and like he doesn't have the money to spend right now. Now, hopefully the book will help some people get to where they do have that independent money to buy before better stuff.
Yes, and I did mention that, and it's okay. And sometimes people keep their prices too low because they feel bad. And I did mention that sometimes price can and should be used as a way intentionally to exclude people. Like I told my first horror story, my first formatting job, I charged $100 for it just for an ebook. And there was a misunderstanding where this gal thought she would be getting a PDF, but I'm like, no, it's just an ebook. So I gave her a KPF file because she was just doing Amazon exclusive. Girlfriend accused me of fraud. I'm going to ruin you. I want
over a $200
thing. $100. So I refunded her. I'm like, okay. And then I raised my prices the next day. Now I still do very simplistic formatting. I don't do the fancy stuff. So I keep the prices low, but I'm like, yeah, I don't want to deal with
someone. I don't want to deal with that problem.
Yeah. And you know, cheap people are cheap people and they're awful. Like, and cheap people are not the same thing as broke people. I always like to say, you know, it's different.
No, absolutely. And one of the other things I always, especially in the pricing, since we're talking about it, you don't want to price yourself too low either, because then people will assume psychologically that you're not of value. If they don't see you near what would at least be a market rate, they're going to be like, what's this person know? You know, so if someone's charging $4,000 for something, you're charging $2,000, you should seriously consider, hey, maybe I should be charging more. Like, I'm sure if you want to undercut them to get new business, but you're going to have a hard time convincing people that you're valuable. If it takes them $4,000, why does it take you $2,000? Like, how are you like undercutting? And it's just the way people understand money, unfortunately.
When you're first starting out, like if you don't have any portfolio and if you don't have any reviews, generally I recommend pricing it low and, you know, kind of getting those reviews, getting a portfolio, and then as soon as you possibly can.
Well, in tandem with the letting people know, I'm new to this and I'm learning, so that's why my prices are where they're at.
Exactly. My very first client that I got by on my own, she started offering editing, and that's what she put it up front. She was like, look, I'm only charging a penny a word for developmental editing right now, but it will go up. Like she said that right out the gate. So she was like, come and get it while you can, because it's going up. And she already had those two books under her belt. So we all knew she's a good author. She knows what she's talking about. Okay. And a lot of people rushed in to get that low price for her. And she raised it. So good for her.
Well, where can people go? They can pick up a copy of this book for themselves.
It is exclusive to Amazon. Right now it is an ebook and paperback, Paid by the Word by Kristen McTiernan. Audiobook is coming out. They said 10 days, I hope next week or the week after, but the audiobook is coming. Yes. And so it is exclusive on Amazon.
Right on. And is there some place if people want to learn more about you and the services that you offer, given that this does go to creatives who may be looking for editors, whatnot, where can we send them for that?
The best place to find me is www.nonsensefreewriters.com. That is my main hub. That's where you'll find my Substack. And there will be a link to my writing and editing services there. So basically everything that is me and Kristen McTiernan's brand of crazy, it's going to be there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I hope people have a better picture of ways that they can make the marketing thing easier on them. Like at least make it so they don't feel like it's sucking the life, sucking the wealth out of them
right.
to do this thing that they just feel compelled to do.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironeedsmarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.